The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening. And can you hear okay? Yes? Okay. So it's the custom here, maybe a little bit louder maybe. Let's see, is that a little bit better? Because I like to hear myself a little bit, but not too much. So, okay. So it's the custom here for me at IMC to give the first talk of the year on the Four Noble Truths. It's considered to be one of the teachings that lays at the heart of Buddhist teachings. And what's interesting about this set of teachings is not really meant to be a teaching by itself, but rather meant to be a practice, something that we engage in, and in the engaging of it, it comes alive and becomes meaningful. In fact, one of the nice ideas, I believe, is that Buddhism itself does not exist apart from people practicing it. That's what Buddhism is the practice of individuals who are moving to freedom, moving to a kind of inner spiritual, psychological liberation. And that down through the ages, the transmission of this practice, this human practice, this practice, this Buddhism as a lived tradition of people who practice it, has been handed down from warm hand to warm hand. It's been handed down from one living person to another. And in such a way that it's generally understood that Buddhism is not meant to be transmitted down through the generations through books. That something about the books, it's easy not to lose the spirit, the heart of it, the humanity of the practice. And so in hearing a teaching, a Dharma talk, one of the approaches you can take for it is not to treat it as something abstract, not to treat it as another. You know, you come to IMC because you're interested in exotic religious teachings from distant places, and you're here as kind of tourists, you know, to kind of... But rather, you're here to understand yourself. You're here to discover yourself, to engage yourself. And so one way to listen to talks is to listen to them not as something that you can disagree with or agree with or that you like or you don't like, but rather listen to them first and foremost as something that maybe you already know is true, or you know is true in certain areas of your life. You already know this. And how do you already know it? And then is a doorway into understanding, yes, I know it's a little bit strange, as teachings, but in that one circumstance of my life, this seems to be true. And then how might it be true in other ways? Or once this door is open and I find out how this is true for me, what more can I learn for this? What does it show me about myself? What further potential does it exhibit? So the teachings on the Four Noble Truths are teachings that I believe we all already practice in our lives to some degree. They're not esoteric or strange or foreign ideas. It's just a formulation of it might not be customary for you and might seem strange. But the actual thing you do that with the Four Noble Truths, I believe most of you, probably all of you, can find circumstances you already do them. So we start with something that's very ordinary. So what's an ordinary example of the Four Noble Truths? Those of you who are new, I haven't even told you what they are yet. So how are you going to answer? But I can imagine that something as ordinary as driving your car or walking down the street, and the street that you want to cross, you can't because there's a red light. And so you feel impatient. Maybe it's important where you're trying to get to. And so you get tense in the impatience and irritated at the light. And you can feel the irritation, you can feel your impatience, you can feel your eagerness staring that traffic light down to see that it turns green. And if you pay attention to that, you notice that it's stressful to sit there, and it doesn't help anybody or help you to be clutching the steering wheel tight and angry at the lights and beginning to compose letters in your mind to the city council about how the light should be timed better. And you can feel the stress of it. Maybe it's relatively mild. And maybe you're paying enough attention, you notice the stress that produces, you notice the situation you're in, you notice this is pretty silly. The light's not going to change any faster for all my tension. So I'm not going to get any faster by remaining tense. Let me at least in these next 20, 30 seconds I have, maybe I can just let go for the moment, breathe and just be here in a simple way. So in that movement, there's a recognition of stress or tension. There's a recognition of something about the cause of it, the conditions that come together, of what you're doing, your participation, your impatience or clinging or tightening up. And there's a recognition that it's possible to relax that. It's not worthwhile keeping it going, that tension, and then letting go. I don't know if this example works for all of you, but I tried to give a very ordinary example. It could be standing in the supermarket line, and the line's going slower. You chose the wrong line. The other line that you could have chosen was longer, now is shorter. And should you change? And you change, and then your line goes faster. Or you go to your cupboards to make yourself supper, expecting to find the rice that you really want to have rice or something, and there's no rice, but you wanted the rice, and you feel yourself getting upset, and then you think, is this really something to get upset about? And you've had a busy day, and it's just not, it's kind of tiring to be upset one more time, and so you say, okay, I'll deal with the pasta. Or something, it's okay. So I hope that you can kind of consider in your life really simple examples where you did something where you reacted in a way that was detrimental to you, was painful or uncomfortable. You could see what your reactivity was, and you decided that this is not worth it, and because it was a mild thing, you could let go. And then there's probably circumstances where all those steps happen, where you saw your stress you were under, you saw that it had to do with something you were doing, and you saw that it is possible, it's not necessary to continue this way, and theoretically it's possible to let go and relax, but it's not so easy because it's more than just traffic lights or rice in your cupboard, but you know it's possible, so you say, I need to do something to help me kind of let go, to relax, to unwind, to settle this issue that I have. And so there's a variety of things you might do. You might go sit and relax someplace, go for a walk and de-stress and unwind. You might go meditate. You might look over your behavior and wonder, maybe something I did today that's bothering me, it didn't feel good that I was misunderstood by my friend because I was irritated and I snapped at my friend, and then my friend feels hurt. And as long as my friend feels hurt, I think I'm going to hurt. I think I'm going to call my friend up and apologize and explain that, I was stressed out and I spoke kind of too quickly. And so by doing that, calling your friend, then you settle something and you feel a little bit better. Or, the variety of things that we do to settle ourselves, to unwind. Some of those things are relatively easy, sometimes it might take a long time to overcome something. So you might be, all kinds of things. But we have a sense that there's something we can do, and so we set in motion the process of doing that. So there's something that bugs us. We see that we're doing something to participate in that. That we can do something ourselves, in ourselves, within ourselves, to relax, to let go, to get settled. And then we can engage in the process to get ourselves settled. So now we're beginning to get close to what the Four Noble Truths are. Before giving you the classic wording of them, there's a problem, there's a cause, there's a solution, or there's a solution that can end the problem, and then there's the actual solution itself. So it's a pretty ordinary process. In fact, it's so ordinary that scholars say that this is the way that medicine was, or illness was diagnosed in ancient India. There was an illness, there was diagnosing the cause, there was a prognosis, and then there was the cure, what you had to do. And so some scholars think that the Buddha borrowed that model, for medical model, for his presentation of the Four Noble Truths. And so one of the ideas is that the heart of Buddhism is an effort, a practice, to deal with, I don't know what we want to call it in English, psychological suffering, spiritual suffering, inner suffering, some suffering that's within us. And that's the illness. And so we have to understand what that illness is. We have to understand that there's a cause. And we know that there's a possibility of a cure. And then there is the actual cure we take. And I like it to tie it to a medical model because it makes it really human. Like, this is pretty ordinary. We're not talking about metaphysics. We're not talking about believing in something supernatural. We're not talking about believing in something in an afterlife that you're going to attain. It doesn't require a god or gods or hells or heavens. It's something that's accessible and something can be experienced and seen by any individual who engages in it. So you could say, well, we're talking about medicine and doctors now, and maybe it's just good psychology, or maybe it's bad psychology. It's just psychology, but I want a religion. I want something that's lofty, that talks to the height and power and glory of the human soul and the ultimate nature of reality that I tune into and get to. And the Four Noble Truths just overcomes our illness. If any of you have some serious illness that's very debilitating, or know somebody, they're probably more interested in overcoming the illness than almost anything else. If you understand yourself, some people understand their own inner psychological suffering to such a great extent, it's so acute and so strong, that metaphysics, gods, philosophy, spiritual teaching, including Buddhism, just are not that important, pale in importance because of the acuteness of their own inner suffering. They want the medicine. They want a cure. So you can see it in someone who's... if Buddhist practice can offer a medicine that's useful for some of the strongest, most powerful forms of human suffering, then people who have that suffering can be quite interested in it. For people who don't have acute suffering, they don't need the medicine, perhaps, or don't think they need it, unless they develop a heightened sensitivity. And with time, people develop a different kind of sensitivity to their existential condition. They say that as people get older, once they have reached kind of middle age and either have or have not established their life, there tends to be a more acute, heightened sensitivity to existential issues and the existential suffering of their own lives. And so they start looking sometimes in middle age, and people who are 40, 50, 60 years old, looking for something different for satisfaction, something different for meaning, because the things they were engaged in with earlier in their life no longer has the same pull or attraction they had earlier. And they don't necessarily have, you know, some acute illness, their psychological illness, but they have something else that's just kind of gnawing at them. See? Something else is important, wanting some meaning or something. And so here again, this Four Noble Truths of the Buddha has importance. We begin looking more carefully at the gnawing feeling, the sense of lack or sense of unsatisfactoriness. Looking at, really looking at the cause, the origin of that sense of dissatisfaction, and maybe believe or are taught that there is a possibility of ending the dissatisfaction, solution to this problem, and there's a path to it. For people who walk this path that Buddhism teaches, it promises something quite dramatic, quite acute or powerful. It offers a radical and total and complete personal transformation where what Buddhism calls dukkha, sometimes translated to English as suffering, is brought to an end completely. And maybe it's a fairy tale that it's possible to end our suffering 100% completely, that there's no more inner angst, the inner suffering, inner despair, inner dissatisfaction whatsoever. It's maybe, some people say, well, just an archetype. It's just an ideal that Buddhists have, and it's not really possible. And who is it, that has anybody really accomplished it and done it all that way? The Buddha is supposed to be the model of that. And I can't sit here and tell you it can be done 100% permanently, you'll never suffer again, because I haven't attained that. But down through the ages and into this age and today, there are people who've walked the Buddhist path and have gone a long way to understand the validity and the power of the Four Noble Truths in such a way that they have become much freer of their suffering, much freer of their angst and dissatisfaction. How far we go on this path maybe depends on how much we practice it and how much time we do. But this path, Buddhism tends to offer a path of practice. It doesn't offer a cliff you step off. Cliffs are kind of sudden ways, quick ways to get down, right? But it offers a path of gradual development, and how far you go depends on how far, how much you practice, how wholeheartedly you engage in the practice, and maybe how long you have. But it also depends on how well you really understand yourself. And so over and over again, Buddhism is helping us try to understand ourselves, get to know yourself better. And that's one of the reasons why in Buddhist practice we put a lot of emphasis on mindfulness. Mindfulness is a practice of developing our capacity to pay attention, and in paying attention, beginning to understand ourselves better, but not only in an intellectual way, in conceptual way, but understanding ourselves by heightened sensitivity, heightened kind of ability to be sensitive to all the nuances and all the different movements of heart and mind that operate within inside of us, so that the subtlety of our beliefs, our attachments, subtlety of our inner psychological operating system gets understood. And subtle does not mean unimportant. The idea in Buddhism is that the most deepest roots, the kind of the foundation upon which our dissatisfaction exists, is quite subtle and quite difficult to see, difficult to encounter. And so it takes a very heightened sensitivity to enter into and see it. So the first noble truth is the truth of dukkha. And the word dukkha is, as I said, is commonly translated into English as suffering. But more and more, I think people are beginning to want to translate it not by the English word suffering because of the complexities of that word, but rather by the word dissatisfaction. That there is, the first truth is the truth of dissatisfaction. From time to time, people have dissatisfaction. They're dissatisfied. And what's really nice, I think, about the word dissatisfaction as a translation of dukkha is that dissatisfaction more clearly points to our responsibility in being dissatisfied. Because dissatisfaction is something that we're doing. It's an activity of our mind. Whereas suffering, you have to kind of explain to people, well, you know, and explain, well, it's your own doing to be your suffering, and the person who is yelling at you is not causing your suffering, and the person who just stole all your money isn't the cause of your suffering. It's really because, you know, it's they're the condition for your suffering, but your suffering is because you reacted to it in some way. And it's a, you know, kind of stretch. You kind of, by the time you finish explaining all that, you lost them. But dissatisfaction, I think, is a little bit more, makes more sense, because it's a movement, it's an activity of our own mind that we get dissatisfied. And so it's easier to take responsibility for it. Because that's what Buddhism is trying to support us in doing, is to learn how we can take greater responsibility for what we are doing in our own hearts and mind, so that we can clean house, so that we can find out what is we're doing there that is causing unnecessary dissatisfaction, or perhaps any dissatisfaction whatsoever. Perhaps it's possible to go through life with the ease and the peace of a heart that's at home, a heart that feels satisfied or content or happy, even though the conditions in the world might not be ideal. I had a friend, the abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center, who just died. He was diagnosed in September of pancreatic cancer. He thought he had a flu. It lasted longer than he thought. He went to the doctor and he left with the diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. And he lived for about 92 days after the diagnosis. So he died on December 31st in the morning. And he was very committed as a longtime Buddhist practitioner, perhaps, as a very upright and dignified man who had tremendous passion and love both of life, but also being true and following a path. So he limited the amount of pain medication he would take so he could be as conscious as he could. And people who were with him said he for the last 3 months he had a tremendous amount of pain during much of that time. But he was going to face the pain. He was going to practice with it. He was committed to be with it. And it got better near the end, apparently. But then Tuesday morning he died. And the people who were there said he died with a smile on his face. So he's a man I've known for 35 years or more. And he's a man who, one of the qualities of this man, his name is Steve Stuckey. He spoke here, maybe some of you might remember, many years ago when there was a fire at Tassajara. He was the abbot, one of the five people who stayed behind and saved the monastery from a fire. And then he came here and spoke about his experience about 5 years ago, I think. He grew up, I think, on a farm in some place like Kansas, with Mennonite parents. And so he had this kind of very upright, self-reliant streak in him. And so you could see, you know, he was a man who was going to take complete responsibility for his own practice, his own heart, his quality of his own mind. And be around him, you felt the sense of he was really here, present, conscientious, intent, and he was going to take responsibility. He's going to, you know, clean his house, be self-reliant, and he came to Buddhism for that support. And he did. You know, he was an exemplary practitioner right up until the time he died. So to take responsibility for ourselves, to not. Someone once said that when you become enlightened, they say when you take refuge in Buddhism. You no longer have cause to complain. So now some people are going to flee when they hear that. No more complaining? I'm not allowed to complain? That's serious. That's a serious religion. No more complaining. Now, you can still see that things are wrong. You can still speak up against injustice. You can still, you know, try to, you know, change the conditions in the world for the better. But complaining is unnecessary. Complaining means that you're not taking responsibility for your own well-being, the quality, the status of your own heart. And so dissatisfaction. We have dissatisfaction, and if we want to take responsibility for the activities of our mind, what we're doing that gives birth to dissatisfaction, it helps to understand the cause for it. And so then the tradition says the second noble truth defines the second noble truth as the cause of suffering, this dissatisfaction, and they put a finger on something that I think in the time of the Buddha was probably not meant to be a technical word, a colloquial, ordinary word of the time. And I think keep coming back to the ordinary. It's so ordinary what we're doing here. And the ordinary word of his time, it translates into English as thirst. And we use that ordinary word in English for things like the thirst for power, the thirst for money. Sometimes it's that kind of thirst. Sometimes it's closely connected to lust and to craving. And so thirst is the cause for dissatisfaction. And how I understand that is that thirst is a particular kind of desire that comes with compulsion, kind of a drivenness, where we can't just drop it easily. If we could drop it easily, if it's just a light, you know, light, easy desire, that thought that went through our mind, you know, I think it would be nice if I could have a Tesla. You know, just kind of, you know, just whiff, waps through. That's interesting, but there it went, comes and goes. That's not a craving. That's not a thirst. But thirst means you can't put it down. It's kind of putting stress and tension in your heart and your mind and your body and your muscles. Like, this, I have to have this. This has to happen. I need this. I'm not going to be happy without it. And we use the things we desire strongly, like that thirsting. Sometimes we have a lot at stake in them. It isn't just simply like, you know, I want to have an ice cream cone, but I want things in order to build up an identity. I want things to people see me certain ways. I want things so I can feel secure, seemingly reasonable enough. I want things so that I can feel safe. I want things so I can be powerful, I can lord over people. I want pleasure. I want all kinds of things. And the pull is so strong that just having the unfulfilled desire sometimes is very stressful. Some of you who have been teenagers with hormones might have remembered sexual desires that might have been so strong that it drove you crazy, that you couldn't fulfill it. Unless you could fulfill it, and you know, made you do all kinds of strange things, because you know, let me, you know, I mean, I don't know if this is not one of the stranger things I did, but one of the more things I'm willing to say in public. was when I was 14, I met a girl, and I knew her first name, and I walked her back to the street that she lived on, kind of a block, I think it was a block away or something. Anyway, I knew the street she lived on, I knew her first name, and I wanted to meet her again. So with my friend, we went through the telephone book, and we could looked up the people who lived on that street, and called everyone on that street asking for her name, until we found her. And he went from the back of the telephone book, and I went from the front, and you're making these calls, because, you know, And there was no Google back then to, you know, make it easier. So that involves a certain amount of strong desire and persistence to go through the phone book that way and call everyone on that street. So, the strong desire, strong wanting it to be some ways. And some of them seem reasonable enough, that a strong thirst and desire, craving or demand or drivenness, for safety and security, for comfort, all kinds of things. But when there's that strong drivenness, compulsion, it in itself can be painful to have. It can be painful to have it frustrated. It can be painful to have something we really want, even if we have it, when we're afraid we might lose it, And we can be painful when we lose it. So the second noble truth is a truth about looking at this compulsive desire, the drivenness, and questioning it. I think one of the great things to do is to put a question mark behind every strong desire you have. Is it necessary? Does it really have to be this way? Even if it's a completely healthy and reasonable desire, is it necessary to have it with compulsion? And this is it necessary to be caught in its grip? And so what Buddhism says is if you want to be free of dissatisfaction, you have to be free of this compulsive activity of the mind. For people who like to be free in general, to be in charge or be, you know, some have some control or some freedom from their inner forces, you have to be free of compulsion, of this drivenness where something else is in charge. And you can feel it, that tension and friction of it in the form of this dissatisfaction. And so then, and this is the good news of Buddhism, which is stated in a very uninteresting way, I think. It just says the truth of the cessation of that suffering. That it's possible to bring that dissatisfaction, that's dukkha, that to an end. But because it sometimes is not easy to do that, then it offers a path. And so the Eightfold Path is probably more ancient in the formulation in Buddhism than the Four Noble Truths. The Eightfold Path is one of the primary repeated teachings that the Buddha gave over and over again. He taught the Four Noble Truths a lot more than he taught the Four Noble... he taught the Eightfold Path a lot more than he taught the Four Noble Truths. So, so the idea of a path is the idea of engaging oneself in a mature, steady, intentional way to slowly and steadily do those things that develop, to use an English expression, develop our character, to develop our inner life. So we create the kind of inner life that's able to both understand the causes of our dissatisfaction, the inner causes of it, and do something about it, and learn to let go. And so we want to look at our beliefs, our understandings, the viewpoints upon which we, and intentions that we live our life on. So to really look at that carefully, question them, and perhaps adopt viewpoints, perspectives, intentions that are more useful. We have to look at our behavior, what we say, what we do, the kind of livelihood we have, what the impact we have on the world around us, what intentions we have in our behavior. And then we have to develop a heightened capacity of sensitivity, to be sensitive, to really be able to see and understand what's going on here. And I find it remarkable that I've been doing this kind of practice for 40 years. I don't know, for a long time, 40 years I've been doing this. And I can see that my own sensitivity to my own operating system, how I operate, my desires and aversions and things, varies and oscillates depending on how much practice I do. That if I meditate a lot, that I'm more sensitive and I can see much more subtle movements. If I'm busy and harried and running around doing things, I don't see quite as much of what goes on. And so how sensitive we are varies depending on what the practices we do and how we cultivate sensitivity, mindfulness and awareness. And so we don't just, if we just let ourselves be sensitive in the way we are running around our busy life, we'll miss a lot of the information. So we do the activities to cultivate the heightened sensitivity within us. And that two things that are key to that are cultivating, developing mindfulness and cultivating and developing inner calm, inner stability, sometimes called samadhi or concentration. And these two together, ability to be aware and the ability to be still and calm, are in Buddhism the preeminent qualities that support our ability to see, both see what's there and to let go. One of the functions of samadhi, of getting concentrated, is not to be concentrated itself, but rather to help the mind get soft and relaxed enough that it's not frozen, it's not rigid, Because when clinging is rigid, when we're kind of locked in, it's hard to let go. As we develop more concentration, the mind gets softer and softer, and so the tendency for the mind to lock in around desires and aversions begins to lessen, and then it becomes easier to let go. So the Eightfold Path is a, you know, comprehensive path of understanding, viewpoints, intentions, behavior, and cultivating the heart and the mind. So you can read about it and engage in it and all these things. I don't want to go through all the list. But what I want to say is that in putting the emphasis on the Four Noble Truths, as especially if you use the old word, suffering, but maybe even with dissatisfaction, if that's kind of said to be the heart of Buddhism, some people complain because they haven't understood the Four Noble Truths well enough, so they complain about the Four Noble Truths. If you really understand about the Four Noble Truths, you would never complain. You might disagree, but you wouldn't complain. because it's kind of negative. You know, these Buddhists, they're kind of party poopers. You know, talking about suffering all the time. But you see, over and over again, in the ancient records of what survived of the Buddha also talked about had very positive or inspiring things to say. I think it's inspiring things to say about the human heart, the mind, and our capacity, our potential. So a couple of examples. One thing he said, the mind, or the heart, it's arbitrary, it's you know, you can translate it both ways, the word. The heart is luminous. But that luminosity is covered over by the defilements that visit it. So the nature of the mind, heart, is to be luminous, is to be transparent, translucent, to be beautiful. But we have these things that visit. So when we don't feel our own beauty, inner beauty, the defilements, our hate, our anger, our greed, our despair, all kinds of things are called visitors. Isn't that encouraging? As opposed to them being inherent and we're stuck with them and that's the way it is. Original luminosity is a little more of the teaching. We were luminous. And some of the myths of Buddhism, also the ancient myths that have to do with kind of creation, talks about the very first beings were luminous beings, self-luminous. And I think it points to this kind of luminous quality that, and you can feel that in people who become free feel an inner luminosity. So that's one kind of positive way of seeing it. So to practice this Eightfold Path, to practice the Four Noble Truths, is to discover that tremendous capacity for beauty, for freedom, for lightness, for openness, that's residing, that's available, that's waiting for you in your heart and the mind. The other teaching I kind of think is nice that I came across today, and is a poem that goes something like this. What is hollow is loud. What is full is, the translation I saw said, what is full is calm. That's just the first part. So what is hollow is loud, what is full is calm. And maybe what you imagine may be like a water container, like a water jug. If it's empty, you can bang on it and you can drum on it, but if it's full of water, it doesn't quite make the same sound. And then it says, before I say the second line of this little verse, poem, Buddhism doesn't have the dichotomy or the duality of the sinner and the saint. That kind of idea doesn't really exist in Buddhism. But Buddhism does have kind of a dichotomy or duality that's much more maybe human, and that is between the fool and the sage. And so then this poem uses that dichotomy, the fool and the sage. The fool is a half-empty jug, implying the fool can be really loud. But a sage is a full is like a full lake. So it suddenly switches images, the poem. So a sage is full, but not just like a full jug, which is kind of small, but it's like a fullness of a lake. The sage here is the person who's walked the Eightfold Path. That we don't become less in walking the path, we become fuller. Clinging, craving, thirsting, lust, hate, all those things are things that make us hollow. All those things are things that make us small, contracted. The path is to let go of those things, a slow process often, but it's to let go of them, so we fill out, so the heart and the mind gets full. Some people hear these Buddhist teachings of no self, not self, and letting go, and think they're supposed to become less and less and more diminished. Kind of become less and less, and you're not supposed to, if you're really a perfect Buddhist, you don't count. You're not supposed to be there somehow. But in fact, it's the opposite, that there's a growth in a fullness of being. And such a fullness of being that you become calm, such a fullness of being that you don't have to proclaim yourself. You don't have to, like a fool, you don't have to, like a fool, to here I am and make a lot of noise to get attention and prove yourself and define yourself and get attention and try to get all the things you want, because you're already at home. You're settled and full and complete. So I'll end with a little analogy that you can think about. And it's good maybe for this cold time of the year. A furnace which is hot, a big furnace, just radiates heat. It doesn't need a small electric heater next to it. When your heart is full and glowing, you don't need all the little things that you're lining up and putting around you to prop you up. So the idea of becoming full, filling out by letting go. Letting go of the things that limit us so we become unlimited. We become full. Is the whole task of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. So I find that I like teaching this because I think it's, to me, it's very meaningful that such a simple formulation, a medical model formulation, when applied in all the different aspects of our life, leads to what Buddhism claims to be one of the greatest forms of spiritual liberation a person can attain. But it's all ordinary. It's not strange. It doesn't require believing strange things. It means just taking the principles, what you learn from when you're standing at the traffic light, and applying it thoroughly to all aspects of your life. Don't just leave it at a traffic light. So that application to all areas of your life is the path. So with that, we start the new year. And I hope that if these Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, which I didn't really enumerate, but that those can really support you in the course of this year. And it's well worth taking it on as a reference point, as a support, as a teaching for a whole lifetime, let alone for a year. I suppose you could see it as kind of building on this theme. For the next few Mondays that I'm going to be here, might not necessarily be here every Monday, but the next few Mondays I'm going to be here. Maybe I will be here next few Mondays. I'm going to, anyway, the plan is next Monday as I'm here, is to give a series of talks on right concentration. So concentration is the last step of the Eightfold Path. And it's a very important part of Buddhist practice, and just filling out and becoming full. And so for those of you who are interested in this topic, that's what the next series will be. So thank you all.